Sunstone does not necessarily endorse the opinions expressed in these presentations, nor the character of the presenters. Presenters must follow Sunstone's code of conduct, available online at bit.ly/sunstoneconduct. Those who violate it are thereafter banned from Sunstone events. Since this session was recorded, multiple people reported having been sexually abused by panelist Tom Kimball. To provide opportunities to learn from the past and to keep the historical record intact, Sunstone will continue to make this session available. For more information, visit sunstone.org/connect/news. If you or someone you know has experienced sexual assault, call the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 1-800-656-4673.
Thanks for coming to our session. 5 years ago, I caught myself walking past the bishop's office, and he pulled me in and asked me to speak with him. He wanted to ask me about my two sons. One would soon be baptized, and the other would be ordained to a deacon. As a brand new church leader, Bishop Abrams felt uncomfortable allowing me to ordain and baptize my sons when I did not answer his questions in a wholly orthodox manner. Over the next 6 months, my bishop and I danced through the issues, and we emerged on the other side with his permission for me to perform the ordinances. As an interesting note, in the course of the interviews, our state president suggested that something move through my arms and into my sons during the ordinance. This was not my understanding of the event, nor my experience in practice or theology. With him, all I could offer was that I had hope, that there was something meaningful present when I voiced the ordinance. Bishop Abrams eventually felt impressed that not allowing me to do the ordinance would be a disservice to my family. In the years that followed, Bishop Abrams and I became good friends and neighbors, and others in my ward found ways to allow me to feel comfortable in my own skin within our ward and our church. I tried my best to return the favor. May I say on a personal note that I felt that Abrams grew into the kind of bishop that people could trust and with difficult issues, and I continue to have a great deal of respect for him and others in my ward. I have a new bishop now, one with a much more conservative, possibly even overly conservative view of our tradition. Though nothing has really changed on my part, I am no longer allowed to use my priesthood. And since then, my sons have not progressed within the priesthood ranks. This may sound selfish, but in our tradition, fathers ordain their sons, and I'm holding to that tradition. In the periods of time when the bishops had withheld from me the right to exercise my priesthood, I was, for all intents and purposes, placed in the same status as LDS women. My authority blocked, my voice suppressed, and if my children are to progress, I have to rely on others. This has given me a unique vantage point as I consider the disparity of power in an all-male priesthood. Boyd Peterson, a longtime friend, wrote a Sunstone article titled In Defense of Male Priesthood. In our conversations, he made an interesting observation once about men officiating in priesthood ordinances on behalf of their children. That's something I've taken to heart and something I've thought a lot about. He said that when conducting these ordinances, we as fathers are nudged into taking on nurturing roles as we bless and confirm and ordain our children. We find ourselves saying to these family members, saying things that we are not normally inclined to do in our everyday lives. Often we as men become pigeonholed as the enforcers and the breadwinners. Women in our tradition are often inclined to become the nurturers and caretakers. And the person in the church, the person in the family that our children first turn to for comfort and understanding. The priesthood in my case has pushed me out of this role and encouraged me to say things to my children that as a father I often struggle to say otherwise. Respectfully, may I share the following example. After I placed my hands on my oldest son's head and ordained him to the office of a teacher, I remember saying something like this: James, at this time, we, the elders of the church, offer you a blessing. James, you come from a good family with ancestors who sacrificed for others so that they could live and find happiness. This priesthood which you've received is your charge to serve those around you. James, you've been given the task of looking after the widows in our ward. And we do have several. And I have seen you to be a friend to the friendless. I'm very proud of you. I admonish you to continue to be an example to your brothers and sisters, to be a servant of your Father in heaven. James, it is important for you to know that your mother and I love you. You also have good neighbors who look after you and serve you. We know that you will do great things. And I closed it. As a father, I struggle to plan opportunities to say things like this to my sons and my daughters, now that this opportunity has been taken from me. I am likely to fail in saying these types of things on my own. I am not accustomed to taking on the role of the feminine or the nurturer. The priesthood offered those opportunities to me, whether I was prepared for them or not. I know that there are drawbacks and dangers in having an all-male priesthood. Presently, I doubt anyone could find a quote from a modern-day woman in any of the current church educational manuals. I feel that women's opinions or points of view are not respected in our tradition. If our family chooses to continue as members of the LDS Church, my daughters will have little chance of having their voice heard, respected, or valued by our larger tradition, and this distresses me a great deal. This may well be the result of natural abuses that occur when one sex dominates the power structure of a community. But I presently view this as more of an example of immature people exercising unrighteous dominion, which we Latter-day Saints are warned about in D&C 121, rather than a male-only priesthood itself being the problem. I also recognize that there are double standards and disparity in the programs of for our children in the LDS faith. While I'm out having scouting adventures with my sons, my daughters are often memorizing quotes, bearing testimonies, and being told that the highest achievement they can achieve and attain is to have children and to be an housewife, an ideal I do not share with my tradition. I have really great daughters, each with unique gifts. I expect to see great things from them. My daughter Ryan, for example, is entering the sixth grade, and she's been given significantly accelerated spelling words, which she quickly perceived intimidate her father. Ryan could be anything she sets her mind to, except hold the priesthood in my tradition. The fact is, the matter is that the LDS Church is not going to give women the priesthood in the foreseeable future. At present, large bodies of women within our tradition are not fighting, protesting, and sacrificing for it. And until that happens, they will not receive it. Since that is the status quo, my attempt here was to offer what I perceive a possible benefit for the priesthood, that the priesthood offers for men. I miss officiating in the priesthood in an official capacity on behalf of my family. It is a loss of something that I held sacred and something that I held some influence and value in my personal maturation. I am eagerly interested in hearing the opinions of Mormon women of all stripes on this matter. I appreciate this esteemed panel for accepting my invitation to discuss this possibly volatile topic from several vantage points, and our panel welcomes respectful input from all those in attendance. Thank you.
First, I want to thank Tom for his very honest and vulnerable sharing with us, and say that I support you, Tom, in your priesthood, and nothing I say is intended to insinuate in any way that you are not called of God. I just want to give you a little brief background. I come from the Community of Christ, and in the Community of Christ, we do not automatically ordain every male. We wait for calls to the priesthood that generally come through a pastor or bishop of a congregation, which means that not all of the males in Community of Christ, even when we had all male priesthood, were in the priesthood. So the question that Tom lifts up is, are there positive aspects or pros or advantages? Are there advantages to an all-male priesthood? Of course there are advantages. The question is, who benefits from the advantages? The all-male priesthood? Women? Children? The church? The body of Christ? The world we are called to serve? The kingdom we are called to build? And turning the coin over to the other side, do any of the real or perceived advantages do harm to others or block the expression of divinely appointed gifts and sense of call? The community of Christ struggle with these questions and many, many more around the topic of priesthood propelled us down a precarious path, questioning our patriarchal practices and stretching us to hear where God revealed in Jesus Christ would have us stand. First, I want to be clear on my perspective in regards to the issue of an all-male priesthood. From my perspective, it is an expression of culture, and its name is patriarchy. It is my experience that peeling apart culture and gospel truths is like removing a large wad of gum snarled in the tresses of a little girl's long, curly hair. Difficult, tedious, and sometimes painful. Once successfully teased apart, actually living out the emerging truths pulls us to uncomfortable places, sometimes to the point of breaking. Both women and men participate in perpetuating patriarchy. The degree of patriarchy in any given society or organization correlates to the degree male privilege is promoted. Patriarchy is male-dominated, male-identified, and male-centered. It is organized around a central focus on control and results in the oppression of women. Christianity, expressed denominationally, reveals a long-held patriarchal tradition. It is a system that coexists in the midst of a patriarchal society, exhibited in greater or lesser degrees depending on local and regional cultures. Salt Lake City culture is quite different from Boulder, Colorado culture, both of which are quite different than the culture of Darfur. What I am saying to you is that ordaining women into staunchly patriarchal systems such as priesthood is a shift in culture which bumps patriarchal walls far beyond those of the church. On April 5, 1984, following many years of dialogue and very heated debate, 80% of the Community of Christ World Conference voted to support Prophet Wallace B. Smith's counsel to the church, providing for the ordination of women, which is now section 156 in the Doctrine and Covenants. After a period of due process, the first women were ordained to priesthood on November 17, 1985. However, it remained a controversial issue. The church experienced a significant schism, including a mass exodus from the church. Half of the active membership in my home congregation left, never to return. It was a difficult time. There were fractured families and broken hearts, tears of joy, and a hallelujah chorus. Those in opposition who maintained fellowship sometimes mobilized support to block conference approval of women's calls to the priesthood. Women were accused of lobbying to get priesthood calls. Some leaders refused to utilize the ministry of ordained women in public ministry or administering the ordinances of the church. Some refused to accept the communion sacrament from women ministers. At the same time, other women experienced widespread support. Pent-up gifts and human spirits now released, even in the face of discrimination, women began to blossom and grow. Tensions dissipated over time. Rarely is open resistance to women in priesthood seen in North America today. Still, women face particular challenges as both male and female strain against patriarchal chains. My story echoes the story of my sisters. Raised in the church, baptized at 8, actively engaged in congregational life. I met my husband, also a lifetime member at Graceland, our church-affiliated university in Lamoni, Iowa. As a young adult member, I participated in every component of congregational life open to females. Our pastor struggled with the advent of women's ordination and did not call any women to the priesthood for several years following 1984. My call to priesthood was processed the fall of 1995, followed by my ordination to the office of elder in March 1996. My children were daughter 13, twin boys 12, and daughter 7. In January 96, prior to my ordination in March, I was appointed and received affirming congregational vote to serve as assistant pastor or bishop at my home congregation in Longmont, Colorado. In January 1997, I became the pastor and served in that capacity for 7 years. It has been a steep learning curve that continues to this day. I came on board as an employed Community of Christ World Church minister on January 1, 1999, assigned as pastor. In November 2003, I was ordained to the office of high priest, and my assignment shifted from the local congregation to the Rocky Mountain Mission Center, serving 30 congregations. In March 2007, I was called into the second quorum of 70, and this April 2010, set apart as president of the sixth quorum of 70, serving the Western USA apostolic field, including Alaska. My husband, ordained in June 1981, holds the office of deacon. He serves quietly and faithfully in our local congregation. He relishes the office of deacon. My priesthood and service to the church has never been an issue. The one comment he offers from time to time is, "I could never do what you do." Our home, as others from our generation and older, suffers from remnants of the Leave It to Beaver era, and I am convinced that my husband was raised by June Cleaver incarnate. Incredibly supportive of my ministry and the associated demands, I'm certain that some of the changes have been a bit alarming. Early on, the whole family adjusted fairly quickly to the new once-a-week supper selection entitled, "Make It Your Darn Self." We all explored together what home life looked like, lived in true community, where everyone had an opportunity to try their hand at the various home responsibilities inside and out. It's hard to teach a middle-aged dog new tricks. So we let Dad stick with some of his old reliable duties, like cutting grass and fishing. Is fishing a community chore? The kids grew up, and then there were two, he and me. He tried not to choke when I announced after one of my two-week trips in the mission field that I was totally letting go of the June Cleaver mystique, and the clothes he delivered so faithfully to the laundry chute would no longer be popping magically back into his drawers and closet, all clean and fresh. 8 weeks later, when his laundry stack reached from the main floor chute to the second floor door, he realized I wasn't kidding and read the Maytag washer instructions. It is sometimes difficult to let go of the advantages of patriarchy and an all-male priesthood. On occasion, when I work late into the night studying scripture and preparing for ministry, I sigh and think about how easy it all was when someone else did this, and I would come on Sunday morning, weary only from staying up late into the night, preparing potluck casseroles, or sewing Christmas costumes, and gluing angel wings. But mostly, I wonder what it would have been like to grow up knowing ordination was a possibility, to be included in all the little things that help young boys learn how to stand in the stead of Christ, to be a deacon or teacher or priest, and travel with an older, wiser minister who would teach me all the details one needs to know that aren't in the priesthood manual. It's an odd conundrum. I still feel a sense of profound loss in the realization that there is no replacement for the years of practical ministerial experience my male counterparts have, most of whom began serving in ordained ministry as young men. I was 39 the day of my first ordination. Yet in many ways, my journey as a woman called late to ministry has propelled me into a depth of experience and understanding I would not otherwise know. I have learned much about the world, men, women, culture, roles, brokenness, social systems, power, invisible lines, invisible people, the Christian tradition, and the church I love and in which I have chosen to live out my discipleship, the community of Christ. Without a doubt, I follow countless women and men who have blazed a trail of change in response to increased understanding of the radically inclusive nature of God. I, too, experience the nuances of patriarchy in and out of the church, sometimes insidious, sometimes blatant. And I am keenly aware that we have only just begun to scratch the surface of change, that both women and men are hard-pressed to identify old patterns and learn new ways of living side by side in mutual, cooperative, inclusive partnership in all aspects of life. To live in a way that is not either or, but rather a new expression of both and. When I was a little girl, it never occurred to me that I would ever serve in ordained ministry. It was men only, in white shirts, ties, and dark suits. My children live in a different paradigm. Women serving in ordained ministry is the way things are. It is normal. It is reflective of the nature of the God they know. All of my children have accompanied myself and others on errands of ministry. They've learned to pray for the sick, preach and teach, serve and lead. They've watched their dad prepare communion trays and their mom consecrate oil for administration. The ministers who sit up front wear shirts and ties, or skirts, sandals, dresses, slacks, in every color of the rainbow. We've learned that change is hard, that listening to the prophetic voice beckons us beyond the status quo, that God wants all of who we are, and we are called to do it together, side by side, shoulder to shoulder, male and female, bruised and brokenhearted, young and old, stretching and growing, a new creation to the benefit of all. We call it Zion.
And now for something completely different. 5 years ago, Hugo Elias talked me into going to Kirtland, and we were lucky enough to get a tour of the temple from Lachlan Mackay. And It was a revelation to hear how the community of Christ talked about our shared history and the fact that they actually provided you with information at church history sites instead of just trying to convert you, even if you were already a member. It made me aware that the Community of Christ does things differently, and I was lucky enough to spend some time earlier this year spend 4 days in a car with a woman from the Community of Christ who told me that in addition to waiting to not automatically giving people the priesthood, you also don't automatically baptize them. Is that right?
That's true. They have to.
Yeah. So, you know, anyway, the point of this is that I was aware as I wrote my remarks that they deal only with the Utah-run branch of the church. And I mentioned that specifically a few times, but I am aware, and I want you to be aware, that this is only about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the headquarters of which is, you know, slightly that way. So, all right. Okay. Here is the basic process of how you get a PhD at an American university. 1, you graduate from high school or get a GED. 2, you graduate from college with decent grades. 3, you pass... I have a little note. Check that this is the correct name. You pass the graduate record exam. I think that's what the GRE stands for. 4, you apply to universities and get accepted somewhere. 5, you do coursework for a few years. 6, you pass your comprehensive exams. 7, you do a lot of research and write a prospectus for a dissertation. 8, you write the dissertation. 9, you write the dissertation. 10, you get a diploma. It generally takes somewhere from 4 to 14 years, and you change considerably over the process. Supposedly, you mature and your ideas become more complex, and you also get poorer and more cynical and tired of living without decent insurance. But afterwards, you're considered an expert in something. Not necessarily something important or relevant to your life in general, but something. You even have a title to demonstrate that. In other words, you have to earn the degree, and there are tests and requirements to help ensure that people do. And while some PhDs are more prestigious than others, the power or relevance of any is greatly limited outside of certain contexts. Having a PhD in art history doesn't help you make wise decisions about investment banking. Here's how you get the priesthood, which supposedly is a great power that can affect almost every aspect of the priesthood holder's life in the Cogecols, which, of course, stands for Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. That's how I'll refer to it from now on, Cogecols. 1, you're born male. 2, you're baptized. Let's say for argument that you're baptized at age 8, which is the soonest people can be baptized into the Utah-run branch of the LDS Church. 3, when you turn 12, you're made a deacon in the Aaronic priesthood, provided that you go to church from time to time and aren't a juvenile sex offender, though there's some wiggle room on that last bit. 25 years ago or so, the bishop asked the congregation of my home ward to sustain the decision to give the priesthood to a kid in the ward. Everyone agreed that this was completely appropriate, except for my mother, who raised her hand to say that she opposed this. It caused quite a stir. It had never happened before in our ward that anyone could remember. After the meeting, when asked why she objected, she pointed out that the boy in question had molested his neighbor's 4-year-old daughter. Eventually, the leaders agreed that this was a reason to withhold the priesthood from the boy, but it never occurred to them themselves. He was 12, he was male, his parents brought him to church. Why wouldn't he become a deacon? 4. When you turn 14, provided you still attend church and aren't in juvie, you're made a teacher in the Aaronic priesthood. 5. When you turn 16, if you're still attending church and not in juvie, you are made a priest in the Aaronic priesthood. It's desirable that you adhere to other commandments of the church, like not fornicating or stealing or getting drunk or high, but I'm sure I'm not the only person who knew her male friends were getting rip-roaring drunk or stoned on Saturday night, then blessing the sacrament with raging hangovers on Sunday morning. Wearing sunglasses and falling asleep while you're on the stand before the congregation is a good giveaway. 6, when you turn 18, provided you're still attending church, not a felon, and express a desire or willingness to have it, you graduate to the Melchizedek priesthood and become an elder, which confuses a lot of people who quite logically assume that elder means dude who is elder. Older. All right, 7. You'll probably stay an elder for a good long while, but eventually, when you're almost old enough to be a real elder, you might be made a 70 or a high priest. The point is, being made a deacon, teacher, priest, or elder isn't a recognition of anything special about a person except for his gender. You don't earn the priesthood if you're male. You can only forfeit your right to it by breaking a commandment, or rather, by getting caught. And as homophobic as the church is, it's striking that being gay doesn't automatically disqualify a man from the priesthood. You can be gay and have the priesthood, you just can't do gay. Getting the priesthood doesn't require any special wisdom or goodness or maturity. Instead, it's supposed to confer those things, except that it often doesn't. Indeed, it can make it harder, not easier, to be righteous, and even Joseph Smith recognized this when he wrote, "We have learned by sad experience that it is the nature and disposition of all men, as soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion." The real point of the priesthood is that it's A, magic, and B, the way you show who's in charge. The priesthood is a mysterious magic power that works when men who have it put their magic hands on the magically receptive heads of others. It's how the sick are healed and evil spirits are driven out and spaces sanctified. The only ritual accessory needed is a little oil to put on the heads of people getting blessings. Other than that, you don't need fire or smoke or special rocks or anything. It's not surprising that Joseph Smith would claim and confer a special magic power, since he was always interested in magic. But the fact that this power is magic does... But the fact that this power is magic means it doesn't have to be A, just, or B, logical. Magic gets to pick who exercises it. Magic doesn't have to explain to mere mortals how it works. Magic only works as magic, in fact, if it's mysterious and unexplainable. If it functions and processes are understood, it's called science. There's my undergraduate education coming in handy again. I picked that insight up in a book I read in 1985 called Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition by Francis A. Yates. I recommend it. The priesthood is an inferior method of running a church and solving human problems because it works without accountability to human beings. It doesn't have to meet their needs, or be fair, or be earned, or be monitored, or be understood. In fact, it maintains its mystery and its power by not doing those things, by being random and selective and illogical and accountable only to a human being, only to a being not of this earth. I confess that I have never understood a certain deference to or interest in the priesthood. It's not just that the priesthood is largely administrative, its holders spend more time making business decisions than exercising its mysterious powers, it's that it seems to hurt all but the strongest, most moral of men, same as political power. I don't know if there's something extra pernicious about the priesthood itself, I'm perfectly willing to believe that there is, or if the problem is the sense of entitlement it so often involves. This sense of entitlement plays out not only in the fact that men with positions of authority feel they have the right to tell others how to live, to chastise or excommunicate them when they misbehave, to ask about the details of sexual activity, you name any of the conventional ways priesthood leaders exercise that authority. It's also obvious in the ways that even men who see the limitations of the priesthood still focus on men's concerns at the expense of women's, and generally privilege men's voices to the exclusions of women's. This is something I've written about repeatedly. Even at Sunstone, there are more straight men participating in panels on how to make life better and more just for gay members of the church, admittedly a very important topic, than there are men on panels about how to improve the lives of women, which should also be an important topic, especially since there are far more women in the world than there are gay people. And again, gay men, at least, can find a way to exercise power and authority that even straight women lack. Furthermore, often those panels ostensibly about the concerns of gay members of the church, though there's rarely a mention of lesbians, are filled entirely by men. Gay men often feel entitled to claim and retain the privileges of the priesthood at the expense of their wives' happiness and well-being. I have never had priesthood envy, mostly because I don't think the priesthood is good for people. This is not to say that I don't want to see gender equality and parity. I do, not only in the church, but everywhere else. But I really doubt that extending to women the LDS priesthood, at least in its current form, is going to help with that. I think it would be better to abolish the priesthood or to reinvent it. In other words, I think that the priesthood is the one ring and it needs to be cast into the fires of Mount Doom. And then it will always corrupt whoever uses it. All right. I realize that's never going to happen, but I still think it would be a good thing. Okay. In a discussion about this panel a few weeks ago, Tom said that he valued the priesthood because while he was exercising it was the only time he embraced his children or told them that he loved them. I said, once you understand that permission to interact with them that way has been given to you, why do you still need these rituals in order to be loving and affectionate and engage in these behaviors that are part of what we consider a healthy, meaningful relationship between father and child? He said, I don't know, laziness. I said, that's bullshit. I call bullshit. And while Tom softened some of what he said in this earlier conversation, I still call bullshit on parts of what he said. And I already asked him about this. We're going to have a little object lesson. So, I can do it. All right, I can do it without. I can do it without. I can do it without touching you. Then, okay. All right. So, I want to make it crystal clear as I do this that I am not exercising the priesthood. I am giving a blessing. Thomas Smith Kimball, by the power and authority invested in me as a human being who tries to care about other human beings, I do not lay my hands on your head and bless you with the desire, capacity, the confidence, and the obligation to offer explicit words and gestures of love, comfort, and approval to your children, even and especially in situations that have nothing to do with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or the exercising of the priesthood it conferred on you. I command you to cease using the priesthood as an excuse for avoiding what you know to be is your parental duty. Do not tell yourself that because you are a man and socialized into masculinity, you have few options or opportunities to nurture those around you. Do not acquiesce to an approach to gender and human interaction that inhibits your development as a human being and stifles love and connection between you and your children. Strive for compassion for others and insight into your own motivation. Hold yourself to a higher standard than the one given to you. Brother Tom, I promise you that there is within you sufficient power and strength to do on your own those things you currently acknowledge that you leave undone unless you have a crutch and a prod, and I challenge you to find that power and that strength. I challenge you, once you have discovered this power, to share it equally with your daughters and your sons so that they might pass it on to their children. I challenge you to be an example to men around you who might also be too reliant on the crutch you have used. Turn away from the unclean thing and the evil practice, for something tainted by the abuse of power is unclean, and something that allows you to evade your obligation to your children is evil. Brother Tom, I offer you my conviction that the world waits to bless us as we learn to bless those around us. I pray that you will enjoy great happiness, wholeness, and well-being during a long and loving life. And I say this in the name of all that is holy and good. Amen.
Okay, I am in the interest of, if, in the blah, blah, blah. Let's just get that out of the way. I'm in the interesting position of being the conservative voice on this panel and defending the patriarchy, which, if you know the stances I take on the internet, is more than a little bit ironic. I have never really taken an official stance on the blogs or in any context, really, on women receiving the priesthood. I guess now that I have sort of been forced to think about why I have not taken this stance, I guess that I have done it for both strategic and personal reasons. The most personal of those reasons being nothing more complicated than pure and unadulterated confusion. I don't know what to say. I absolutely believe that the way things are now is not ideal, to say the least. But I also have very little faith in my own ability to solve these problems. It isn't that I'm not clever or smart or, frankly, right, because, of course, I'm right. It's just that if there's one thing I believe for sure, it is that people are weak and lazy and selfish and fond of status and power. We like to feel important and in control of our world. And when I say we, I really mean we. I love power and control as much as anyone. And creating any organization or religion or government that keeps these weaknesses in some sort of check is, well, nigh impossible, I think. Of course, I love the ideal of an egalitarian utopia, and such a place, but such a place can never exist. we can never be it. Okay, let's. Yeah, can never exist. Be it racism or sexism or homophobia or classism or elitism or just people who think they're smarter than everybody else, we humans will always create a hierarchy. We will always grab for status and power. It's what we do. It makes us feel good. That said, it seems that we should all at least strive towards equality. And how does one do that in a system as hierarchical and patriarchal as the Mormon Church? And how could one possibly defend something that exploits and justifies its inequality under the umbrella of God's authority? It seems to me it is one thing to say, well, people love power, so of course, inequality. What else? It's another thing when you say, well, God wants this inequality. And by the way, it's not really inequality because women already have motherhood, and I'm surprised you didn't know that. So let me just say that as I take this step to defend the patriarchy, that I do so with a few reservations. All right. I grew up in southern Utah, and in my home, my father presided. He was considered the head of the household. He was in charge, symbolically and practically. He controlled the money. He called someone to say a prayer, and if there was a decision to be made, he made it. My mom was a really strong woman, but she truly believed that he was in charge, and she did what she had to do to try and make that happen, even though, I mean, I guess if I were to look at them, I would say that my mom was more of a natural leader. And in this home, I had a truly, truly lovely childhood. It was idyllic. My parents loved me. I felt safe. I felt happy. I never, ever questioned that something was wrong. I didn't feel like something was missing. I didn't feel like anything was unfair. My dad was in charge, and that was just the way it was, and he loved me, and my mom loved me, and we had a happy home. I was happy and fulfilled, and I didn't feel oppressed. I didn't feel a sense of uneasiness. It didn't occur to me until I was much older that there was something wrong in the picture. My love for the gospel was real. I loved Mormons. My bishops, my male authority figures were kind and good men who loved me in the best possible way. I never once, and I know this is weird, but I never once had a bad experience with male priesthood authority. I still, to this day, have not had that experience. The Mormon men that I have been submitting to in my life as a feminist woman have all been so kind and generous and fair to me. And in some ways, some of my most powerful experiences in life have come when these men have put their hands on my head and blessed me. The times when I felt most loved, when I felt God's presence, have been times when the men who love me and have been kind to me and who expect me to submit to them have blessed me. And I think that we need these rituals. I think they formalize the power of our love for each other and God's love for us. And I don't know about you, but even just now, in Holly's blessing, I felt a power in that formalized ritual. And I believe in that, even though Holly doesn't. I believe that God was here with us. I know that my experience is an unusual one, and I have heard hundreds in my position as a Mormon feminist woman, I have heard hundreds of abuses of male power and authority. And in many ways, I wonder, and maybe even believe, that at their very core, the fault of these abuses not only lie in the individuals who perpetuate them, but in the system that encourages and empowers these individual men. And again, I've got to circle back around to defending the male patriarchy. So, we live in a sexist world. If Joseph Smith had never found those plates, and if my crazy ancestors had never followed Brigham Young across the plains, this would still be a sexist world. As they say in Mormon parlance, the world teaches our boys and men that they are weak, beer-swilling, selfish, hopeless, sports-obsessed. I can't read that word. Something. Sports-obsessed, you know, bozos. That's what it says, bozos. See, sports-obsessed bozos. And as much as I hate to admit it, yes, because I want the world to be simple. Once again, my handwriting's getting worse. Okay. And as much as I hate to admit it, because I want the world to be simple, I do think that boys are different from girls. I don't mean this necessarily in a gender essentialist sense. Be it nature or nurture, I don't care. I don't think it matters at this point. Boys and girls in this culture, broken culture, true, are different. And boys are desperately seeking examples of manhood to emulate and admire. And as uncomfortable as it makes me, the priesthood provides many boys and men far nobler examples of manhood than the not-so-egalitarian world provides. It would be nice if boys and young men would be all equitable and their heroes and mentors could be women, if they could look at women as examples. But they do not. They do not. Yes, it is part of our sick culture, but this is the culture we have. And we can't make that go away by wishing it. Boys need male mentors, and Mormon male mentors are oftentimes great ones. And frankly, I have more than once been a bit mystified by the manhood because of my culture, because of the way I was raised. I've been mystified by the manhood as betrayed by the world. I hate kind of separating things into the world and into Mormonism, but, you know, I'm so entrenched in Mormonism that, you know, sometimes there are things, because I've been so Mormon and around so many Mormons, that there are things about, you know, like the outside world culture that sometimes mystifies me. And one of those things is often the way that men are betrayed in those beer commercials and in, you know, sitcoms, and because it's not a man that I really recognize from my own life. And maybe that's true of non-Mormons as well, but my brothers, my father, my husband are all serious, kind men, not afraid to be emotional or loving or spiritual in the context of, yes, the priesthood. Granted, I do believe that they love they express here, feel safe to them, despite the fact that they could be mocked in many settings in the world for being unmanly or whatever. But because they have this like position of authority, because they can express this love from this, yes, this elevated position, they feel safe kind of in their expressions. And it provides them a context and a ritual in which to do it. And they are willing to make themselves vulnerable from a position of power. Is this unfair? Heck yeah, it's unfair, but it's also kind of practical. While the overall patriarchy does hurt me, it hurts me deeply, makes me sick, I also feel that in some very real ways it has also blessed me. The gift that I have gotten through the patriarchs in my life being willing to be a different sort of man, yes, because they have a power that makes them, that their weak human selves feel a little better than me in a way that they wouldn't admit that they feel better than me, but that's what they're doing. It has been a gift in some ways. It's just complicated, all right? My dad was a quiet man, and he was a man of his time, and he was a sexist man. He was a good, kind, loving, well-meaning sexist man. Who wanted me to be happy, and who supported me in everything I did. When I went and decided I wanted to play basketball, despite the fact that we had very little money, he went right out and bought me a basketball. basketball. Like, the next day, he was so excited to support me in that. He encouraged me to go to school. If I had decided to be a lawyer or the president, he would have been all for that. But at the same time, he really believed the best thing for me was what I eventually chose, was to be a wife and mother. But for all of his love and his support, his paradigm was never going to shift. He was never, ever, ever going to see why the patriarchy hurts me. To him, it was and is, you know, a righteous extension. And I have no idea what time it is.
Okay.
To him, it was and is a righteous extension of God's power. And there are so many men like him, especially in his age bracket, that just cannot see or understand or comprehend. And yet, I think that in many ways, having that male power has been good for them. Oh, blah, 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 something. And this is, I wrote a little note here, says, defend Tom here. So, you know, as I listened to Holly's blessing and her commanding him to express, use those pathways of love in other senses outside of the priesthood, a part of me says, yes, 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 men need to do that. And another part of me says, the practical part of me says, but, you know, here we have Tom, who is an extraordinarily open-minded feminist man who himself struggles to express those things and to do those things. You know, if Tom is struggling to do that with or without the context of the priesthood, how do you take someone like my brothers who have no concept of feminism, no understanding of why it's important to me, just really don't understand, don't get it, their paradigm is completely different. You know, though, it's just not going to sink in for them. It's not anywhere on their radar. All right. I guess just, you know, in closing, I just want to kind of say that the history of the patriarchy is, you know, no different really from the history of every other kind of patriarchy. You know, Joseph Smith's paradigm was that he was looking back at the ancient church and, you know, the ancient patriarchs and trying to emulate them, which is why we end up with polygamy. And if you look at kind of the structure of the church, it's really more like, you know, kind of the Roman system than the system that Jesus set up, because, you know, it looks like, according to Bridget Jack at least, that, you know, Jesus was ordaining women, or that women were serving within the primitive church, which is, you know, kind of our ancient paradigm. But really, if, you know, we feminists are constantly looking for strings. We're looking for strings of where women served or where women had power, where women had authority. But really what we have is centuries and centuries and centuries and centuries and centuries and centuries of patriarchy. Those are the examples we have. And our church is going to be very slow to change. And our structure, as much as we... No, let's see, that's not it. And I guess... I would like to hope that what we have now is a transitional state where we can use the priesthood for the good in the ways that it can be good for men. As, you know, a feminist, as a mistress of the patriarch, that submits to the patriarchy in a very uncomfortable way, that I can hope for, and see the best in the power that in the power that men use, and see it as a flawed transitional power that can help men to express a lot of the things that will help them get to a better place where we can have some true equality. And I wish I could articulate that last point better, but that's the best I can do it, defending the patriarchy. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry for getting respectful. Thank you for your blessing, Holly. We now have plenty of time for question and answers. I'd like to step up to the mic if you're interested, and we'd be happy to field some of your questions.
Holly, I have a question for you. I was curious, by virtue of your introduction qualifying that this is applying to the Utah Church, if you have explored the membership in other restoration traditions like the Community of Christ.
If I'd consider joining the Community of Christ?
Yeah.
No. Okay. I have no interest. No. Okay. I'm not going to become FLDS either.
Is it okay if I ask two questions? So my two questions are, one which I think should be at least on the minds of most people here, which is that the question that the panel is based on has not been answered, I think, which is not what are the benefits of having priesthood for males, but what are the benefits of an all-male priesthood? Which, I mean, obviously it's been answered by some. I think Holly answered pretty well. So that's my first question, which maybe you two could address, or others if they'd like to. The second question that I have is maybe impossible to answer for lack of time for historical lecture about it, but I just want to know, I guess, what made this possible for the Community of Christ? And why was that a move that the Community of Christ was willing to make and that the Utah-run LDS Church is not?
Robert should really answer this one, but I just wanted to say, if you're very curious about that and would like an in-depth analysis of it, there is a great interview John DeLynn does with John Hamer on Mormon Stories that answers that question in depth.
I think one of the pathways for the Community of Christ is that we embrace community and embrace the prophetic impulse as being part of all of us, a people with a prophet, but a prophetic people. And so when we come together in community to struggle with serious issues, we very intentionally try to listen to God's voice and those inner senses of where do we need to grow. And many people in our movement were impressed that an all-male priesthood was not in alignment with the way of God. And it took a long time. I think if we look historically, we see some evidence of that bubbling up fairly early on. I think in the 70s, it really came to the fore of our discussion together. It was not an easy thing to deal with, but we continued with it. And I think as a people, we were very courageous to take that step. We made mistakes. And I think we did the best we knew how when Section 156 came forward. Since then, I think we've learned better ways to deal with very controversial issues and to allow ourselves and to learn how to sit with one another, very much in the way that is described on the front of this book, in respect and listening and honoring one another's perspectives. I think that sense of community and journeying together and our sense of understanding that the restoration spirit continues to call us to change and grow and hear God's voice and respond to God's voice today is what allowed us to have a path and the courage to take that step.
With regards to your first question, I guess I tried to understate it, but what I was basically getting around to is that with an all-male priesthood, along with its baggage, is that I find that service and being forced to, or not being forced, but being prodded along to taking on the feminine in the nurturing role of blessings for my kid, it was some of the benefits that I saw.
But that it would not have happened if it. I just feel like it's worth the follow up. But those are benefits that would not have accrued with a gender neutral, say, priesthood.
I don't know.
Yeah, but it lessened your priesthood if we had it.
But in my case, because I'm sort of pushed into this role, it forces me into this uncomfortable thing that I've had to, you know, take on for myself.
I recently read a book that was sort of life-changing. It's called Bodies by Susie Orbach, and in the way that so many Mormon men read church history and suddenly go, wow, there's shit I didn't know about. I read this book, and it articulated certain things about the world that were really important. You know, if you, like I said, the first thing that has to happen for a person to get the LDS priesthood is they have to be born male. And in this book I read, the author discusses the fact that baby boys are nursed more frequently, for longer intervals, and often weaned later than baby girls. Now, I seriously doubt that there's any mother in this room or in this continent who would admit to saying, oh, yeah, my baby boys needed my sustenance, needed my milk so much more than my daughters. But that's just what happens. And the only thing that's different about those children is their genitals. Boys get more of the world's resources and nurturing from the second they come out of the womb, and I really don't care about arguments about why they need more of our emotional resources when they're grown up. Man up! Be a grown up! Love the people you need to love, and don't rely on these external things for permission or opportunity or authority to do it.
Please.
I'm in agreement with Holly, and I just wrote a blog post and didn't publish it about how the priesthood is like the One Ring.
You're actually who said that to me, so I did steal that from you. I stole that from you.
Holly stole something. But I do think that there's a great deal of value in a structure, and I think there's a great deal of value in not a hierarchy, but I think that in a feeling of position of power, and that what the major benefit of a priesthood is to give you a sense of self-esteem and a sense of purpose. I tend to see the priesthood as a tool, like a hammer. I think a lot of people have said this or thought this, that I fail to see how the benefits that you experience in the priesthood come because you are it was only of offer to men. I tend to see, like, as an elementary school teacher, I have paper passer outers. And one time, like, and there were only two at first, and I found out I needed more, so now I have six. And it still gives them the benefit of passing out papers and feeling that they have accomplished something. I made everyone risk it their own paper. They would still feel the benefit of being able to have a job. And I think that it's like a hammer, and I fail to see how, if everyone had a hammer, and if my little sister were to grow up feeling that she also expected to run organizations and lead and give blessings, how that would take away from a male priesthood. I mean, even if it was just within the church community, wouldn't that give them a feeling of purpose?
I think Robin probably has the most insight into that, and by the way, Robin, thank you for coming to be part of our panel.
You've
added a great deal to us. I appreciate it. Before I turn, can I just comment? The one thing I was trying to bring up with regards to my story was, you know, like my bishop. You know, when I walked into his office and he didn't hear the orthodox yes, 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 you know, he immediately, you know, yanked my ability to baptize and ordain my son. And it was the discussion. I watched my bishop grow up over the next 6 months, and I watched him become really a pretty good guy. and there were some bad stuff that happens in a ward, and I saw him be the kind of guy that people would want to go to help them solve their problems. And I think that for him as an individual case, I saw that this conflict and having to do this issue and having this responsibility forced him to kind of grow up and to become really kind of a remarkable person.
I have to admit that I struggle a little bit as I listen to the LDS tradition describe priesthood, because it sounds very different to me. The Community of Christ understanding of priesthood is not really about authority per se, but about servant ministry.
But they would say the same thing.
Okay.
I have heard that, yeah.
Okay. So, at our best moments, those who function in the priesthood, male and female, are willing to kneel at the feet of others and wash their feet, metaphorically, and to empower all around us to share a message of hope and peace and reconciliation and wholeness and love. And to me, that's an opposition to a under-the-thumb kind of authority, shame-based, judgmental presence. That's not to say that that does not happen in the Community of Christ and that it hasn't before, because it has. I would also underscore that having a non-gender-based priesthood is not keeping priesthood away from anyone. It wouldn't keep priesthood away from males. I struggle to understand, beyond the fact that we do live in a patriarchal society, and I think we have to look that square in the face and understand that when there are benefits to a system for people who receive those benefits, it's difficult to let go of it and to share power. I mean, it comes down to power and control. What I've experienced is at our best moments, when male and female serve together in the priesthood, there is an incredible blessing that takes place in that, and that the authority of the ordinances are magnified, and that the church is truly blessed, and that we're capable of bringing much greater blessing to the world. We're called to serve and bear a message of hope to. And is that answering your question?
And maybe just one more quick. So what is everyone afraid of? Like, I wake up in the morning, I'm like, I can imagine that tomorrow, women will get up and, like, there might be some 12, it might make it more behavior-based and less gender-based. It might be like, I could walk up in the morning and then a 12-year-old girl could be ordained and then she could grow up and become a bishop and she could sit there and she could have two male counselors, one, and nothing would explode and the basics of the priesthood would still, like, not, like, I can imagine even things people don't like wearing suits and ties, I can imagine wearing a woman wearing a suit and tie. Like, and still, nothing would change, and the same thing, you would do the same things and you would feel the same power. So I fail to see why did people leave and why are people afraid?
I think Holly really touched on some of the issues that had to do with that, because the way things are, it's very secure and safe, and it's very, very difficult to change, and it frightens people, and I see that over and over again. It's not just about priesthood. It's about any kind of change, and the closer that gets to foundational core health beliefs, the more frightening it is. It's absolutely terrifying. And so any change like this has to take place in community and willingness to sit with one another and hear those hard stories about what bring us to the position that we are on that issue, no matter where that position is, and walk through it together and acknowledge those fears and confess in our own reluctance to let go of power.
I'm sorry.
We've almost all of them so far.
Anyway, I was thinking about the idea of the all-male question, why that's different than having a gender-neutral. And as far as the example of the paper-passer-outers, if I'm understanding right, the idea of priesthood in the home belonging to only males means that there is a priesthood leader in the home. And I think something I've heard brought up is that if men and women could hold the priesthood, then there would be two priesthood holders in the home, which, like, as dictated by the typical division of labor in the normal home, then that division of labor, that priesthood responsibility, would be delegated to the mother or the female priesthood holder as well. That doesn't really have any bearing on my opinion about all of this, but I think that that is the idea of the benefit of an all-male priesthood, is that it requires males to take on that role and doesn't give the option or the responsibility of that role to women.
There are plenty of men who are utterly secular who manage to be partners in their homes. I have heard so many excuses. You know, basically it's pretty much guys like this and they want to keep it. That's really all I've heard.
I just want to say, it's not that I disagree with Holly. It's just that I honestly think Holly is an idealist. I'm not kidding. Like, she has this ideal that she loves, and she loves this ideal, and she thinks, well, just man up and do it. But it's kind of the same answer that you get from Orthodox Mormons when you say, well, you know, that doesn't really work for me. They say, well, man up and do it. Or, you know, that doesn't work in my context. Well, man up and do it. It doesn't, like, if people aren't thinking that way, if their brains don't work that way, if that's not their paradigm and you tell them to man up and do it, they're not going to... People don't just... Like, in abortion debates, so often people come into our blog and say, just don't have sex. You know what I mean? And I feel like it's kind of the same answer. If it's completely outside of... If it's completely outside of their reality, if it's completely outside of a teenager's reality to tell them not to have sex, which it is for many teenagers, they're going to go out and do it. Men are gonna go out and be sexist. You know, to tell them to man up and do it will work for men like Tom who listen, but it's not gonna work for men like my dad who have a completely different paradigm. And he's still a good man, and I do think that priesthood, in many ways, was good for him, while bad for me at the same time. It's complicated. It's both.
Hey, Bill.
I think there's plenty of evidence that you could say that women, on average, are more spiritual than men. Women go to church more, pray more, and you know, are more religious. I think you document that pretty well. And I agree with those sociologists who say that that in institutions or any organized group, those in power do not give up their power. They write the rules to preserve their power. And other philosophers who say that. As Robin was suggesting, that marginalized groups don't get equal power without fighting for it. And so if anybody wants to respond to my generalizations, welcome.
Yeah, I sort of touched on that in my paper, and that until women stand up and fight, we're willing to sacrifice, like Margaret Toscano's and the Genesis Reds, there's not going to be a lot of change in the LDS Utah tradition.
I beg your pardon. Until women are willing to stand up and fight. Thank you for ignoring and denigrating the efforts of so many women here today who are already doing things. That was lovely, Tom. Yeah, none of us are standing up. None of us are fighting. So that's why nothing's changing.
You don't even want to be here in the church. You're not even going to church.
You asked me to be on this panel.
You asked to be on the panel.
I agreed to your request.
But I wasn't saying fight in any kind of, you know, militant way. People can fight in all sorts of...
I'm glad they're both on the panel. I just want to say, as you know, as the, you know, Orthodox Mormon, you know, I am, you know, Holly's a little bit right. I feel like I do stand up and fight, but... again, it's a paradigm. So many women don't want to stand up and fight because they feel safe. And, you know,
All right, well, I guess not to kind of perpetuate what we were just saying, but just kind of a preface for my question. I personally have never felt oppressed or looked down upon by the priesthood holders of my church. And so kind of my question is, as was mentioned in the panel, priesthood kind of allows room for unrighteous dominion. And so if you take to heart the belief that men and women are equal, you also have to take to heart the fact that they are equally corruptible. So how will women getting the priesthood resolve that problem is my question.
Hold on.
I'm having a little sense of deja vu because about 20 years ago, I made a presentation entitled at Sunstone why women should not seek the priesthood. And I wasn't quick enough to add the subtitle, which I should have, nor men either. I have three questions, I guess. Is the priesthood primarily the honor of power, or is it the power to serve other people? Second question is, these last two are really the hauling. You use the phrase to improve the lives of women. Some men should do things to improve the lives of women. And I guess my question is, whose responsibility is it to improve the lives of women? Is it the men who hold the priesthood, or men generally, or society, or is it the individual women themselves who have the primary responsibility to improve their own lives? Third, Polly said, power, the priesthood power, always corrupt those who have it.
That is not what I said.
Okay. That's what I wrote down. That's what I heard.
That's not what I said.
I can't resist this, Holly. If that's what you said...
It's not what I said. Do you want to hear what I said?
Okay, yeah.
Yes, I can find it. I confess that I have never understood a certain deference to or interest in the priesthood. It's not just that the priesthood is largely administrated, it's that it seems to hurt all but the strongest, most moral of men, same as political power.
Okay. Well, I think even Joseph Smith said almost all men. He didn't say all men.
Neither did I.
Okay.
Thank you very much for listening to me. Yes, thank you.
And I just wanted to say, if somebody ever said that, they ought to be grateful that we've saved them from being corrupted by having this power. But I would like to hear your response to whose responsibility is it to improve your life? And what is priesthood, what is its real purpose?
I honestly don't know what the real purpose of the priesthood is. As for whose responsibility it is to improve the lives of women, well, I can tell you that in terms of many things, women are told it is their responsibility. For instance, if women don't want to get raped, they shouldn't wear certain clothes, they shouldn't drink or hang out in certain places, because men can't control themselves and women are always the cause of the misfortune that befalls them. This morning, I got up and logged onto Facebook and found a link to something called Men Can Stop Rape, and it had posters with men with saying things like, "When my girlfriend was too drunk to say yes, I didn't have sex with her." Or, "When she said no, I stopped." And the above the photo was the line, "My strength is not for hurting." And at the bottom were the words, "Stop rape." Now, I believe that those people got it right, that it is men's responsibility to stop rape. Rape is something that hurts women a great deal. All sorts of violence, you know, motherhood is the leading indicator for poverty in the U.S. Pregnancy is the leading, well, actually, the being murdered by the father of your child is the leading cause of death for pregnant women in the United States. So you tell me, whose job is it, those women's job to save their lives, or is it the job of the men who kill them not to kill them? You know, is it women's job not to get raped, or is it men's job not to rape them? It is human beings' jobs to make life better for each other. But too often, the job of making life better for men has fallen to women without men picking up the slack of making life better for women in return.
Amen.
Before I ask my question, anecdotally, I want to say to Holly and Lisa, you were right. You made me feel terrible about holding the priesthood. So. My question is more from a pragmatic stance. I've really loved all the talks about feminism at this conference, mostly because I don't understand your position. I've never grown up as a woman. I don't understand the things you go through. And I find that frustrating because I hear so much injustice, and it pisses me off, but I don't understand it. So from a pragmatic standpoint, as one who has been given the priesthood, can you tell me what I or any other man can do to benefit the lives of women, to empower them, to help them become better? Like, I can't call up Tom Lawson and be like, hey, buddy, let's have a talk. No, I can't do that.
Seems to me the problem is that's not really a priesthood issue. It's more of a male issue, and a cultural issue, rather than a specific priesthood issue. Because the priesthood is supposed to teach us to serve and to be gentle and to follow Christ's example. And there are those that corrupt that and use it to abuse and aggrandize themselves.
I have a follow-up question. Would you ever encourage the abdication of certain priesthood responsibilities in favor of women's rights?
Yes. Yes.
In the church?
Imagine what would happen if all the men who really want to see equality for women simply said, I will not hold a calling. I will not accept a calling in this church while women suffer so much. That could make a really big difference. And yes, that's idealistic, and I realize not very many are going to do it, but it would make a difference.
Sorry for cutting you off.
Oh, that's okay. I was just going to answer the question previous to this, just to offer some of what I've learned. I've interviewed lots and lots of women in the community of Christ about this journey towards priesthood. And one of the things that I heard over and over again is that women need to share their story. They need men to hear their story, to sit with them and listen to the pain and listen to the frustrations and understand that. So that's a really big thing, I think, that men can do. I also want to say that we might benefit by looking at the civil rights movement and the work of Dr. Martin Luther King and how a community that was greatly oppressed in this nation, what were the steps and the strategies that they took, and to recognize that it took people that held the power to walk with the people that were being oppressed. And so dealing with patriarchy, dealing with having a priesthood with both male and female, means all of us, women and men, working together to change that.
First, an anecdote. I was impressed one day when my husband told me that he was in a bishopric, and he told me that how important it was for him to be in this bishopric because while in his faculty meetings, he sat around and they tore apart each other's work. When he went to these bishopric meetings, all he did was sit down and talk about how he can help the lives of the people around him. And while I know that a lot of what they were saying, I'm sure, was misguided, they don't have the full story. I know there's a lot of supposition that goes on, but they were just trying to sit around and help people. So I don't really have a problem with that. My problem, of course, comes in that women are not invited to the table in these discussions, as they sit around and want to help people. And so what I would love to hear, especially from the wonderful lady from the Community of Christ, is what is the real fallout of women having the priesthood? I don't see anything bad happening, when we invite women to the table, in community with their brothers to sit around and talk about how we can help the lives of everyone. What bad thing happens? And maybe you can talk about, in the Community of Christ, has there been, people are always afraid that if women step up, men are going to step down. Did we see that in the Community of Christ? And if any other people have, thoughts about what bad thing could really happen if women get the priesthood? Loss of revenues. You mean men won't pay their tithing?
I think has a lot to do with money. I really do. I think the church is a corporation, and they are funded by by tithing dollars. And tithing dollars are often earned by men. And I'm not saying that anybody's wicked, but I really think it's a business decision.
Go ahead.
I'm cynical that way.
One of the things that the Community of Christ did as we journeyed towards this decision was women were invited to sit at the table. Women were invited to participate in ways of decision-making and collaboration without holding priesthood. But that was a kind of a change that the church began to make, trying to access and give an opportunity for that voice to be heard. So it was kind of little incremental steps. We did experience a huge schism in the church, we did experience a huge drop in revenue in response to that. For those, so some people did not participate in experiencing both genders in the priesthood. It has been a difficult transition in many ways because we live in a patriarchal society. So it bumped on those walls, and there's no way around that. You just have to work through it. And women participate in perpetuating that system, sometimes unknowingly. Men, and men too. The best meaning men, we have to relearn what we're doing, and awareness needs to increase. There are lots of ways to do that. They even have training manuals. Congregations can do diversity training that has to do with gender issues to help prepare and become aware. The first step is awareness. So we experience fallout. We experience, you know, learning curves and learning how to relate to one another in new ways. But it's coming out okay. Now, in patriarchal societies, something that we see happening frequently, like in careers, if women suddenly begin to have a higher percentage in a career, you will see a male drop-off. And that is a direct correlation to the patriarchal system, because value is based on male. So if there are more females in a career, the perceived value of that career drops just because the female has this kind of stigma. And I think that we do see that play out to some extent in the church as well.
I'll be quick. I just want to respond to what Melanie said. I have a mission. I have remarkable mission presidents. And I don't want to say that there are no good men who, you know, there are plenty of good men who exercise the priesthood. I just would like to see them do it without a crutch, to be good men without a crutch. But one of my mission presidents was talking. He was remarkably candid, and I was in Taiwan, and most of the women who joined the church, most of the people who joined the church were women. And my mission president said explicitly, "I've been told to baptize more men. Women don't produce enough tithing."
Kim, last question.
So I'm not sure it's a question. It's actually a response to somebody else, but you never know who's going to respond from the panel. And I don't want to hold myself as any kind of example, because I've got a tremendous amount to learn, but one of the things, I spent a long time as a teacher's quorum advisor and priest quorum advisor, and I told myself that I would take that calling only if, you know, twice a year I really impressed on the guys what it was like, what my sister's life in the church had been like, and how difficult it was for her not having a priesthood, and that, you know, they need to be aware of that and think of that, and it's not only women that can tell women's stories.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for attending.